Blog Talk Radio.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Good morning, listeners. Thanks for tuning in to the Dynamic Dojo Radio Show with Rashida and Robert. It's Sunday, July 7th, 11 a.m., and you are listening to another episode of the Sunday Brunch Show. Our schedule's gotten a little messed up, so we're doing Sunday Brunch's show. It seems like we've been doing them all month. I don't know. But before we get started, I'd like to bring on my brother in the martial arts, Sifu Robert Deal. Sifu Bob, how you doing today?
Hey, doing well. It's nice and cool down in Southern California for a change. It's only about 80.
Oh, it's only about 80.
Only about 80. And, you know, Tuesday I announced on Facebook my daughter was injured very badly. We thought she had a concussion and she had the symptoms. So I took her to the doctor on Wednesday when we could. She got in late on Tuesday, so we couldn't go until Wednesday anyway. And she was all jacked up on her side. You know, she jumped off a 50-foot cliff, right?
Oh, or gosh.
A 50-foot waterfall. She somehow turned sideways and bounced off the water on her side. So she had all these impact injuries, all these bruises. Well, my doctor is probably the only doctor in existence who actually will slap their patients when they get out of line. So that can imagine what kind of that can tell you what kind of relationship this doctor and I have, because she's probably slapping me all the time. So she said, you know, she wrote up a slip. Now, take into consideration, this is a day before a holiday, a major holiday.
Right.
She writes up a slip for a CAT scan, and she says, you know, go in, get the CAT scan, keep your eye on her, see if she acts a little off. Then she says, well, more off. And I looked at her and smiled and said, thank you for clarifying that for me. Crack! Right across my shoulder. And then she hit me with the other hand.
Oh, your doctor, gotta love her.
I one more story, and I swear I'll shut up. Brandon, my son, had problems at one time where he has what they call a normal abnormality. He has like this bulge on his left pec, but it's within body tolerances. We had the MRI, the whole bit done. Well, and at that time, somehow, and he still doesn't know how he did it, he broke his foot. So we're going up, and it's funny, his orthopedic surgeon and our Filipino doctor, great doctor, are in the same building. Well, our Filipino doctor has her sister as her nurse, so we're heading up to the orthopedic surgeon, and my doctor and her sister are coming down. Well, I'm telling them about the break, and the doctor starts talking about the enlarged breastplate, basically, on my son. And my doctor feels his chest, and then she says, come on, Cecilia, which is her sister, feel right here. Feels his chest, and I looked right at Brandon, and I said, wow, I wish I had two great-looking Filipino women feeling my chest. And this came out of the doctor's mouth. And I said nothing after it. She looks at me and she says, Bob, when you get a gross, we'll feel it too. What could I say to that? All I did was smile. She put her finger in my face and she said, PG-13, Bob, PG-13.
What a great doc. Oh, my gosh.
this woman is just, she's incredible.
That's
just
awesome.
Incredible doctor. Funny.
That's awesome. Oh, my gosh.
Those are my stories, and thank God the CAT scan came back negative. My daughter's fine. So,
oh, good, good.
That.
50 foot, you know, and oh, my gosh, you know. And you said she threw up.
I figured out something, though. And she did have, you're right, she did have the symptoms. She threw up. She did all this other stuff. I can't say anymore. If your friends would jump off a 50-foot waterfall, would you, too?
That's right.
Because I know she will.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. But I'm glad she's okay. Oh, my God. That was scary. That was scary. All right, listeners, our phone number here is 347-677-0699. We've got a great show ahead of us. In about another half an hour, we're going to have Paul Zajcik of Elastic Steel and Lori Kadamian of Kibukan Nutrition that will be joining us, talking to us about proper nutrition and proper stretching methods for martial artists. So if you're a martial artist, and I guess you are if you're listening to the Dynamic Dojo Show, do listen, you know, do stay tuned and listen in, because, you know, this this information is good for all types of sports. So, you know, if you know great athletes out there, if you have friends that are athletes or do other sports, give them the link. Tell them to tune in, because you might be surprised at some of the old school stretching that we grew up with as martial artists and athletes. You know, it might be obsolete, and it might not actually be working as well as it could be. So tune in later for that. All right. So I had a pretty interesting weekend, too.
I understand. Why don't you share that with us?
Okay, I'll make this really quick before we go into shout-outs and health news and weird news. Okay, so I was coming out of the Staples office supply yesterday, or not yesterday, Friday. Yeah, Friday. And just as I was coming out of the parking lot, I hear this big crash and a car horn. It sounded like an accident, right? So I looked around, and anyway, I looked across the street, and this is in my area town in Kent, Washington, and this is a major intersection, 256th and 104th. Major intersection. There's a point in the intersection where there's five lanes of traffic that you would have to cross if it were possible to cross. And this is where it gets interesting. A car comes blazing out of the Rite Aid drive-thru across the street, clips a car, knocks down like a small tree, clips a fire hydrant, runs over the sidewalk, goes over the median, okay, not just the little road bumps, but the median, you know, those things that stick up like, you know, a foot or so off the ground, goes over the median, over the sidewalk on my side of the street and toward the parking lot, right? So I'm standing there in shock going, what's he doing? And he hits this embankment that is below the parking lot. And I thought, oh, gosh, he's going to hit the embankment. No, he didn't hit it and stop. He hit the embankment and went over the embankment, caught air, and ended up speeding toward me in the parking lot. And I stood there like an idiot, right? Deer in headlights. Now what? And but when his tires hit the ground, because this guy caught air. I couldn't believe how much air this guy caught. When his tires hit the ground, his car started to turn a little bit, and he hit this tent. Well, when he hit it, I realized that it was a fireworks tent. So I'm like, oh my gosh! So I start running toward the tent as he crashes into it. And in the back of my mind, I'm saying to myself, why the hell am I running toward this tent if he crashes into a fireworks tent, right? But I get there, and it's good and bad. When I get to the tent, I realize that it's empty. They had emptied it out after they sold the fireworks, and they just had tables laying around and stuff. But I got to the back end of the tent, and all I could see were two metal posts of the tent that had gone through the windshield. I couldn't see anything else. I just saw a windshield and two metal posts through the windshield. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I don't know if I want to see the rest of this, right? So I lifted up the flap, expecting to see, you know, some guy impaled, you know, through his seat. But there was this guy trying to open the door, and he's shouting over his car horn because his car horn is stuck. And he's like, I can't get out. I can't move. I can't move. And I'm like, well, hold on. You know, don't move. You know, I was the first one there. Don't move. It's all right. And I stick my head in the window, and I realize that the pole had gone into his groin and into the seat. And he's like trying to move the pole. And I'm like, sir, don't move the pole. Don't move the pole. And he's like, I got to get out. I'm like, I don't think you should move right now. I was afraid he was going to bleed out if it indeed had gone through his groin and into the seat, right? And,
right.
You know, at first I thought that it just caught his clothing, but I'm like, well, can you move your legs? And he moved his left foot, but his right leg was all in, like, these weird positions, like under him and stuff. And I'm like, that doesn't look like it's going to move. He's like, I can't move my right leg. And I'm like, okay, don't move. Don't touch the pole. But he started freaking out. He kept shouting, I can't move. I can't move. I want my phone. I want my phone. Where's my phone? Where's my phone? And I'm like, is there someone you want me to call? And he's like, I need my phone. I need my phone. And I thought, oh my God, this guy's in shock. This guy's not with it right now. And I turn around and there are people standing around. And I'm like, somebody call 911. And I pointed at a lady and I said, you, call 911. We're on 256 and 104th in the Staples parking lot now. And then a second later, someone else said, okay, there's help coming. I'm like, okay, good. But it took them about an hour to get this guy out of the car. And it turns out that it wasn't a full impalement, even though there was blood everywhere. You know, I thought, oh, my God, you know, how are they going to get him out? But they managed to get him out about an hour later. It wasn't a full impalement. It was more of like a crotch package impalement. So this poor guy's going to need some work done on his crotch in that aspect. So, but they got him out okay, and I hope he's okay. But that was interesting, because for like an hour, it was just an hour of just pure adrenaline, you know, seeing that, hoping that he wasn't going to bleed out on me and stuff like that. It was, I'm glad he's okay. So, phew.
Cross impalement? That was very eloquently said.
Yeah. I guess it's a lot better than, you know, well, getting a pole through your package. I don't know. Oh, my goodness. All right. So, interesting weekend for both of us. All right. So, let's get to our shout-outs. I think you've got a couple shout-outs. I see that there's another great shout-out from Elaine Yamano.
Always. It seems like she's always got something going. Elaine Yamano is sponsoring a tournament next weekend on July 13th. That's next Saturday.
Oh, right
on. I'm sorry, what?
I said right on.
It's the UConn Na Samurai Tournament in Laughlin, Nevada on July 13th next week at the Tropicana Hotel and Casino. As most of you know, it is affordable and ran very, very well. I have great room rates at both the Tropicana and River Palms. $21.99 Thursday. Sunday and Monday rates are $41.99, Friday and Saturday per night. That's what it said. It makes no sense, but that was the way it written and was not my fault. I read over it again and went, wow, that really makes no sense. But they've got great room rates. Keep that in mind. Book now before the prices go up. It may be too late. I mean, it's only next weekend that you may end up getting a higher room rate. There is a block of rooms saved you will need to book by the weekend to get this awesome rate. Very cool.
Very cool.
If you have any questions, you can email ysrk7757@gmail.com.
Right on.
Now,
very
we're
cool.
Go on. It's supposed to be in a tremendous tournament. Cal State Games. The California State Games will be featuring over 8,000 athletes competing across 24 sports. Online registration is available at www.calstategames.org. The entry fee is $55 and will cover up to five events.
Wow.
This rate is good for online only. For information, contact Sandy Amundson at sandy.amundson, that's sandy.amason at gmail.com. And it's Saturday, July 13th, 2013, at the Town and Country Hotel, Golden West and California Rooms. That is located at 500 Hotel Circle North in San Diego, California.
Wow. Yeah. Right on. Well, $55 for five events?
For five events. That's like unheard
wow.
of.
That, yeah, that's about $150 right there, you know, just for, you know, smaller tournaments. Wow, that's
right.
Crazy cool. Check that out,
it
folks,
is.
calstategames.org. That's awesome.
Now, do you mind if I move straight on into the museum shout-outs?
Let's move on to museum shout-outs.
Okay, Martial Arts History Museum in Burbank, California at 2319 West Magnolia Boulevard, Burbank, California, 91506. Today, July 7th, 2013, they will be honoring the life of Alexander Fu Sheng from 7 to 9 p.m. The cost of this event is $40 because it is a dinner event. You will be served dinner. Doors open at 6. They want you to arrive by 6:30 so that they can be serving dinner. What they're going to be doing is they got a bronze bust of Fu Sheng's head donated, and they're going to do an unveiling tonight.
Oh,
so
wow,
like
right
cool
on.
Cool. Now, they're going to have on July 13th, they're going to have Takaboda Day from 4 to 6. The cost of this event is $6. Please join us as we honor icon Takaboda as we celebrate his life and induct him into the Martial Arts History Museum's Hall of Fame. July 20th. There's going to be a kids' day at the museum. This event is absolutely free. The details will come at a later time. And if you want to go to any of these events or if you want to find out about them, go to the Martial Arts Museum History Museum's website, which is mamuseum.com. And I've got last one. They're going to have their... on September 7th, 2013, they're going to have their Museum Honor Award ceremonies. We are proud to announce the 9th annual museum ceremony is being changed to the 9th annual Honor Awards. Please visit www.museumhonorawards.com to make your nomination. From what I understand, however, it may be a little late to make nominations because the acceptance of nominations were due on July 1st.
Yeah, it sounds a little late.
Your tickets and come out and support the arts. And those are my shout-outs.
Right on. Yay, Martial Arts History Museum. Now, speaking of the Hall of Honors, I just want to tell our listeners there that you, Sifu Bob, and Hanchi Dan Hecht, the CEO of the Masters Hall of Fame, have been nominated for induction into the Museum Hall of Honor. So congratulations, Sifu Bob.
Oh,
right on.
You.
Congratulations. Well deserved.
It was one of those where I got the letter, I got the email, and I went, no, this has to be a joke. I actually went down to the museum and saw Michael Masuda and says, no, I was actually nominated by Art Camacho.
Wow.
And I said, no, this can't be right. So
very
I accepted.
Cool.
I gave them all my pictures and bio like they needed, and I'm good to go.
Very cool. Awesome. Congratulations. That's going to be a fun event. I wish I could go. I don't know. If I win the lottery, I might
when you hit
the
lotto, yeah, I was going to say, you're traveling a little bit too much.
Yeah, it's a weird year for traveling. But wow. So yeah, congratulations again to you and Hanshi Dan. Very cool. Very cool. All right. So I just want to remind our listeners that in a little bit, probably another 15 minutes or so, we're going to have our guests Paul Zajcik and Lori Kadamian with us. We're running just a little bit behind on time. So if our guests are listening, we will be getting with you two when we get done with this particular segment. So hang tight, everybody. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and do my shout-outs real quick. I just want to do a quick shout-out to Sensei Lori O'Connell and her great blog. And you can check out her blog at Pacific Wave Jiu-Jitsu. And that's Jiu-Jitsu with a J-U-J-I-T-S-U instead of G-U-Jitsu. All right, so PacificWaveJiu-Jitsu.com. And she's got a great blog post that I've posted on the Dynamic Dojo Facebook page called 5 Defining Characteristics of a Good Martial Arts Teacher. So check that out. Check that out, especially if you're new to the world of teaching martial arts. Check that out on the Dynamic Dojo Facebook page. All right. I've got another event announcement here. This is a workshop called Essential Oils for the Martial Artist. And this particular workshop is being hosted and held by a Kajikembo sister of mine, Michelle Pleasant. So on Monday, July 22nd, here in Seattle, Washington, if you've ever been curious about essential oils, how they work, and how they can be beneficial to you, this would be a great opportunity to dip your foot into the pool. This class is going to be gearing toward the martial artist slash athlete slash yoga types of people who may have a more intimate relationship with their bodies and how they work, and may be more in tune with your body's with their body's inner workings. Now, essential oils, for those of you that aren't familiar with it, can help with healing from sprains, strains, and bruises. It can improve lung capacity, strengthen chi flow, increase vitality and energy, promote a calm, alert mind, help create a positive attitude, and ease emotional stresses that sometimes arises during your training. So, you know, as we know, our bodies respond to nature in very organic and sometimes extremely powerful ways. And these essential oils are 100% natural and are a very potent distillation of the amazing healing capacity of nature. In a world where there is a pill for every little ache, pain, or body malfunction, essential oils offer a natural alternative to pharmaceutical remedies. So go to the Dynamic Dojo Facebook page and look for the essential oils post there. If you're in Seattle, do check it out. Michelle Pleasant is a wonderful Kajikembo and Tai Chi instructor, and this would be a great workshop for anyone to attend for people that are new to essential oils. So pretty cool. Awesome. All right. I think we're into health news already, I think.
Yes, we are.
We are. All right. Well, let's get into our, that was a little loud. Let's get into our health news. I need to do something about my sound effects or something. All right. So this particular health bit is about the health benefits of holy basil, also known as tulsi. All right. And I'm going to be posting the complete link to this article on the Dynamic Dojo Facebook page here in a little bit. Now, holy basil, also known as Osimum tenuiflorum, let's see if I said that right, Osimum tenuiflorum, it's been used as a healing herb in India for a very long time. Tulsi is different, though, than standard Italian basil that we put on food and stuff like that. It's different than the regular Italian basil in that it is lighter in color and milder in flavor than the Indian basil. So Italian basil, little less so than the Indian tulsi. All right, tulsi is considered to be an adaptive balancing different processes in the body. That made no sense. Let me... This is what I get for cut and paste, Bob. I'm sorry.
Also, it's not always me.
No, it's, this is how I got it off the article. But tulsi is an adaptive herb which balances different processes in the body. And it's helpful for adapting to stress, allowing us to adapt to the everyday stresses. Tulsi protects from nearly all sorts of infections, from viruses, bacteria, fungi, and protozoa. Marked by its strong aroma and astringent taste, it is regarded in Ayurveda as the kind of elixir of life, quote-unquote, and is believed to promote longevity. Now, some of the benefits of tulsi are it can help with respiratory problems. Holy basil is effective in treating cold, in treating colds. This is how I'm reading it. It's effective in treating colds and related disorders. Heart disease, it can help with heart disease. Because tulsi contains vitamin C and other antioxidants, which protect the heart from harmful effects of free radicals. It's also good for stress. Vitamin C and other antioxidants, apart from repairing damages done by free radicals, can minimize the stresses induced by these oxidants. Tulsi soothes nerves, lowers blood pressure, and reduces inflammation, and thus reduces stress. And another one, and I don't want to take too long here. The last one I'm going to mention as far as benefits of holy basil is it's extremely effective in treating headaches and body pain. It has certain properties that help in releasing spasms in the muscles, hence is extremely helpful in relaxing the body, and which is probably why it's really good at relieving headaches and pain. Now, there are other benefits to tulsi, also known as holy basil, and I'm going to put the link to this article on the Dynamic Dojo Facebook page, so go check it out in a few minutes. Pretty cool. Awesome. Now I'm going to have to go out and get me some.
Thinking something that is very, very close to holy basil, and it makes a very good laxative. It's called... I'm sorry, I couldn't make it through it. It's called holy crap.
Oh, it would have been great if you kept a straight face for that one.
I couldn't. Before you stopped, I was thinking about it, and I was chuckling, and I couldn't make it through it without just busting up.
Well, I
had a great need for a laxative. Holy crap.
I almost made a joke about it at the beginning of the article. You know, it sounded like a Batman, you know, a Batman and Robin thing. Holy basil, Batman.
Right. I was thinking that too.
Oh, my God.
I was just crying. I was laughing so hard.
I know, right? All right. So that was it for the health news. So for our listeners out there, our phone number here is 347-677-0699. As I mentioned a little bit earlier, we are running a few minutes behind on this particular segment. So, you know, stay tuned, though, because a little bit later we're going to have Paul Zajcik of Elastic Steel on the line with us, as well as Lori Kadamian. And then we're going to be talking about proper stretching methods and nutrition for martial artists. So don't go away, folks. Besides, you know, listening to the first segment is always so much fun with the weird news and weird laws and stuff like that. So we hope to have our guests on here in another 10 minutes or so. So let's, with that said, let's get into Bob's
Weird News.
All right. What do we got for weird news, Bob?
Well, it appears in... I hate these names sometimes. That's why I give them to you, because you can just pronounce them. Multnomah County, Oregon. A
Multnomah.
Squirrel
yeah.
Knocked out a power of almost 10,000 people Monday morning.
Oh, my God.
KOIN reported. The furry fellow got into a substation around 7:40 in the morning Monday, causing an outage that left 9,134 people customers of Portland General Electric without electricity. PGE spokeswoman Elena Medina told Oregon Live that an animal simply has to come into contact with a power line to bring the whole system down. Wow.
Medina
told, can you imagine an animal just come in contact with it, shut a power grid down, just like nothing?
I guess it happens a lot. Mice and squirrels and, you know, other gnawing animals like that.
Right, exactly. Medina noted that most of the time the animals don't survive. Power was expected to be fully restored around 10 a.m. The same thing happened near Gladstone, Oregon, just days prior to that, leaving about 5,000 customers without power for about 3 hours. Oregon isn't the only place where squirrels are taking down the infrastructure. On June 24th, a squirrel crawled into a substation equipped in Wichita, Kansas, causing a transformer blowout and starting a fire. Almost 10,000 customers of Westar Energy were out of electricity for about an hour. In 2012, more than 3,000 people in Northern Virginia lost power when a squirrel got into a substation and blew a transformer in Arlington County. An official noted that while sometimes squirrels survive these kind of shocking encounters, the squirrel was killed in this particular incident.
Aww.
Wow. Oh, wow. I know.
That sucks.
Now, these weird laws this week come out of Ohio.
Ohio.
In Youngstown, it is illegal to run out of gas.
What the hell?
Oh, God.
They must have a problem with this next one, too.
Okay.
In Ohio, I can't imagine this, but in Ohio, it is illegal to fish for whales on Sunday.
Unfair!
Who's going to fish for whales? Do they really have whales in Ohio?
Yeah.
And who's going to fish for one?
That's an awfully dang big hook that they're going to need.
Yeah, Captain Ahab. Yeah.
I can't believe that's a law. I can't.
I can't either.
Oh,
it
my
is
gosh.
It's illegal to mistreat anything of great importance.
What? What?
She's like, hey, I was like, what? It is illegal to mistreat anything of great importance. Now, that can be subjective. That can be very subjective.
Oh, okay, Ohio people. Y'all have some weird laws.
That's why they call them weird laws.
Oh, my goodness. Oh,
I wish
here we
I
go.
Would have made it through holy crap, though, with the straight face.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that was it for Bob's
Weird News.
All right, let's go ahead and take a short 3-minute break. In that time, we're going to get a hold of our guest, Lori Kadamian. We're going to catch her on the one of the phone lines. It looks like one of our guests, Paul Zajcik, is already online. We have him on hold, so we'll bring him on here in about 3 minutes. So we'll be right back after this, folks. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Today in school, I learned a lot. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes me. In English, I learned that I'm disgusting. And in physics, I learned that I'm a loser.
Today in school, I learned that I'm ugly and useless. And in gym, I learned that I'm pathetic and a joke. In history, I learned that I'm trash.
Today in school, I learned that I have no friends. In English, I learned that I make people sick. And at lunch, I learned that I sit on my own because I smell. In chemistry, I learned that no one
likes me. Biology, I learned that I'm fat and stupid. And in math, I learned that I'm trash.
The only thing I didn't learn in school today...
The only thing I didn't learn is why no one ever helps.
Kids witness bullying every day. They want to help, but they don't know how. Teach them how to stop bullying and be more than a bystander at stopbullying.gov. A message from the Ad Council.
This is Nnamdi Asamoah. I play football for the Philadelphia Eagles, but what I do off the field with United Way might be more important. I'm a volunteer tutor and mentor. Why? Because over a million kids a year drop out of school, and that's not okay. It takes 12 years to create a graduate, but it takes about the same time to create a dropout. And the difference between a child becoming one or the other could be me, or it could be you. Studies show that if we get to these kids earlier, their chances are better. And kids who read well by third grade are more likely to graduate. So join me in United Way. Suit up and take the pledge. Become a volunteer reader, tutor, or mentor. Because when a child succeeds, we all succeed. Give, advocate, volunteer, live united. Take the pledge at unitedway.org. Brought to you by United Way, the Ad Council, and the National Football League.
In 50 feet, turn left. Why are you driving so slowly?
After a few drinks, I'm taking it slow.
Well, you're not fooling the cop behind you.
What?
Get ready to pay in 0.1 miles.
Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
And now, on with the show.
All right, and we are back. Thanks for joining us. This is the Dynamic Dojo Radio Show with Restita and Robert. If you're just now tuning in, we are going to be talking with two experts on proper stretching and nutrition. Our phone number here is 347-677-0699. So if you have any questions about stretching methods or proper diet, feel free to call in, 347-677-0699. We also have our chat board on the Blog Talk Radio Show marquee. So if you don't want to call in, go ahead and write your questions there on the chat board. But come on, folks, don't be shy. Go ahead and call in because it's more fun that way.
It is.
Awesome. I'm really excited about today's show. What I'd like to do first is I'd like to introduce our first guest. Our first guest is Paul Zeitzik, and he is an athlete and martial artist and the founder of the Elastic Steel method of athletic conditioning. Now, Elastic Steel is based on years of research on many Eastern European stretching and gymnastic techniques, as well as Paul's own experience, and was developed as a system to meet the needs of the modern martial artist. So it's our pleasure to introduce Paul Zeitzik to all our listeners. Welcome, Paul. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Rusty. Hi, Bob. How you doing?
Hey, Paul.
We're doing really good. Now, for our listeners out there, for those of you that aren't familiar with Elastic Steel, Paul is a regular contributor to the Dynamic Dojo Facebook page and has incredibly helpful videos. So if you've never checked out one of Paul's videos, do check it out and find all of his videos on our Facebook page. So thank you for joining us. And to introduce our next guest will be Bob.
Thank you. I want to introduce and welcome to the show Lori Kadamian, which is a wife of a good friend of mine and a friend of the show, Chris Kadamian. And she works at Masters in Motion in Burbank, California, and she is an absolute nutritional expert in her field. Welcome, Lori.
Thank you so much for having me.
Awesome. Well, we are really excited to talk about this because, you know, being an old school martial artist, you know, as well as Bob and many of our listeners out there, you know, I myself was brought up with old school, I guess, outlooks on nutrition and stretching. So this is a perfect thing to talk about, considering that a lot of training methods have changed over the last 40 years or so. So this is going to be great. So let's go ahead.
When you and I were brought up, there was almost no nutrition. It was, we train for an hour, we go to Tommy's and have a double chili burger.
That's right. Oh, my goodness. Well, let's go ahead and start off. I want to start off by asking Paul first. Paul, can you tell us a little bit about the Elastic Steel method and how is it different from, like, let's say, the old school types of stretching and conditioning that many of us older martial artists grew up with?
Well, Elastic Steel is, like you said, method of static conditioning, and it's usually divided into three parts: strength and conditioning. A lot of it is bodyweight training. We also have focus on the kicking techniques. We have systems specifically for kicking, speed, power, precision of the kicks, and we have a system specifically for flexibility, fast flexibility. The second question was, how is it different? Well, I can give you, I guess, two examples on that. Traditionally, the martial artists used to warm up with static structures, sometimes floating structures.
Mm-hmm.
Some schools, some isolated schools, even a long time ago, used dynamic structures as a warm-up, such as very few did. Actually, very few still do. But that became the norm later on to use dynamic stretches. And so it sort of progressed from there. Now Elastic Steel is trying to bring in kinetological stretches, which is totally different from everything else before that. You know, that's for the warm-up. And then for general stretches, for general flexibility, general is a very bad word for flexibility, actually, just like for strength. You know, you can't do general strength. But it was the same thing. It was relaxed stretches that were used for a long time. PNF, for excessive kinematical facilitation, actually existed since the 1950s, but martial artists began to adopt it, according to my knowledge, at most 20 years ago, and still very few schools use it. So it progressed to that, and now more and more shorters begin to warm up with dynamic stretches. Kick specifically, I believe that the best warm-up is the typical inhibition stretches, but it depends on the skill. It depends on which skill you go with. I guess that's what it is in a nutshell.
Awesome, awesome. Well, I'll be asking a little bit later about some details about the specifics and differences between PNF and dynamic stretching and passive stretching, because there are a lot of martial arts students out there that really have no idea what those methods are. They just do what their senseis or sifus tell them to do. I think it would be great if you can explain that a little bit later. So we'll get into that a little bit later. All right. And Bob, back to you.
Very cool. Well, Lori, what got you, I've known your husband for a few years, but what got you interested in specifically in nutrition aspect?
I always had a passion for science, when I was younger growing up, and I just was fascinated how the human body worked. So I saw from an early age as an athlete how nutrition impacted my performance. So I really just wanted to learn more, I think, and I was interested in doing something in the science field that I could be involved in helping people, working with people, but I didn't want to be a doctor. So this was sort of the next best thing in my mind, which was to just, really start to understand how God created each of us and how it's just amazing how we get up and we work every day and the things that make us go is basically what we eat. So that's pretty much it in a nutshell. I was always fascinated by it and still am.
Very cool.
Oh,
very cool.
Very cool.
Awesome. Now, I forgot to mention at the beginning of this particular segment that Bob and I like to have these types of discussions done in like a roundtable type of fashion. So Paul and Lori, if you want to comment or ask questions of each other as well, please feel free. And callers, please, listeners, please feel free to call in if you'd like to join the discussion, because it's more funner in the roundtable discussions for our listeners to join in. 347-677-0699. All righty. Now, I had a quick question, Lori. Now, I know a lot of people that jump into the fad diets and stuff like that, only to fall off that bandwagon when they don't see the results. They go, I'm not seeing results in whatever time, so I'm just going to give up. That's kind of their mindset. Now, can you tell our listeners how does proper nutrition play into losing weight in a healthy manner? And for others, maybe for gaining weight, because I know that there's some athletes out there that actually opt to gain weight. So can you tell our listeners
nice?
A little bit about that? Yeah.
I'll preclude that by saying most of us women don't fall into that category, sadly.
Yeah.
as much as we'd like to. Absolutely. That's such a great question, Rashida. I think just the very nature of the name fad diet kind of just, you know, let you know what it's really about, which is a fad. And what, you know, I have found over the years is that the sort of more popular ones, like we have Atkins or things like that, are repackaged. They kind of cycle through. They get popular, then they, you know, die out, and about 10 years later, it gets popular again. And here's the thing about it, you know, if there was one magic thing that worked, we'd have one magic thing for losing weight or gaining weight. Sadly, you know, it's not really a sad thing, but because we're each made differently, one thing does not work for one person. And the other aspect of that, of course, is the discipline aspect, because we would all like to have that magic pill in any one of these sort of fad diets that will help us get results. And many of them do, but here's the basic thing I think to remember is, funny enough, it's really kind of about math. And basically it's about how many calories you take into your body and how much you expend. So it's about movement or exercise versus how much you're taking in. And that's, of course, I'm going to quantify that in the, you know, healthy individual, barring any medical conditions. So these fad diets definitely work. But what happens is, you know, you see usually you see an initial, you know, good amount of loss, because it's such a drastic difference in terms of how many calories or the amount of food that somebody takes in that they're encouraged. But the difficulty is that they're very hard to stick to, because they're either very low in calorie, or they're very low in carbohydrates, which is basically what, you know, carbohydrates are, you know, like bread, pasta, potatoes, even fruits and vegetables, and that makes our body go. So when you eliminate all of those things, a lot of times people struggle with energy. So a healthier way, it's not to say that these things won't work for a time, but again, it goes back to the math. So a healthier way is to, you know, figure out what works best for you as an individual. And of course, sometimes in some cases, people need quick results, even though it's not the most healthy thing. But really, it's about finding a moderate amount of calories that, and moving more so that you're losing at a steady pace, but keeping yourself satisfied and sustaining energy through that time. So whether you're an athlete or just sort of the average person, that's really the trick, you know. And then within that, you need to, you know, you need to tweak things a little more. If you're a competitive martial artist, then obviously that's sort of a different thing, which I think we'll probably get into a little bit later. So
yeah, awesome. Now, speaking of like fad diets and stuff, what, you know, I've always wondered about this, and I was wondering if you know if I could get your take on it. Is where do these fad diets come from? Do medical professionals come out with these, you know, or if something worked for somebody, like a celebrity or something, do they just assume that it's going to work for everybody? I was always wondering about that. Where do these diets come from?
Yeah, that's, again, a great question. I think it's a mix of all of those things, you know, because, you know, Hollywood people, especially, you know, where we live near Seafood Bob, so we're in Burbank, you know, Hollywood area, and people see them and they always look beautiful, and they, you know, and everybody wants to look like them. Of course, we forget that they're probably somewhat genetically either gifted or enhanced. So that's, you know, everybody doesn't forget about that. Some of them definitely do come from doctors. You know, I remember I grew up on the East Coast, so there was this, you know, famous diet, you know, I'm sure you heard of it out here. It was called the Scarsdale diet. It was from a doctor who was from Scarsdale. So here's the thing, though. I kind of mentioned it earlier. You know, there's like over 30,000 or maybe even more now, you know, quote-unquote diets listed. And I think that it's definitely a very lucrative commercial area. So some of it is definitely by doctors, and, you know, some, you know, it is, like you said, you might see, you know, somebody who's famous or somebody who becomes famous because they've had success. And there's always good takeaways from all of those things. But again, it ultimately comes down to that math equation, calories in versus calories out, whatever it is. So, I'm, you know, hopefully that answers your question a little bit. I think that there's kind of a mix, you know, even some of the juice fast, for example, there's one years ago that you could only obtain from a doctor. I am not personally a proponent of that because they're super low calorie. So my thought is that they were only able to be given out by a doctor because you needed to be supervised by the doctor because they were so low calorie. And again, there are cases for that, for somebody who's, you know, morbidly obese, which is, you know, probably has 100 or more pounds to lose and that sort of thing. But for the average person, they may work for a time and there's a place for it, but it definitely stresses the body. So it's not the best thing in my book. But again, it depends on your goal. So.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Awesome. All right. And Bob, I think, didn't you have a question for Paul also?
I did. Paul, is flexibility necessary for martial arts? And is there such a thing as somebody that is too flexible?
Ooh, good question.
Ooh. Okay. Well, is flexibility necessary for martial arts? The thing is, a lot of times people single out sports that have obvious flexibility in them, like martial arts or dance or gymnastics or figure skating,
mm-hmm.
or somebody going over the hurdle. And we would think, well, the flexibility is necessary for them, and it's really not necessary for somebody else. But in real life, flexibility is needed for any type of athlete, and what a lot of people don't understand is the following. Your flexibility does not, your upper range of flexibility does not start where your range of motion ends. So in other words, if you are doing, let's say you're doing a front kick, and mm-hmm. so you are hooking the knee and you're extending your kick, and at some point you find that your knee does not extend anymore if you have a high chamber. So that's the point where your end of range of motion actually ended. But if you pay attention carefully to your muscles, you will see that the resistance begins to build up a lot earlier than where you actually extend it to. So another example would be, if I was to bring my arm over my head all the way up, maybe 180 degrees is where my range of motion ends, but the resistance to that range of motion does not start at 180 degrees. It started a lot earlier. So what I'm doing is, maybe from 110 degrees to 180 degrees, I'm experiencing more and more resistance. So I go from 110 to 120, and I got extra 5 pounds already on my arm. 120 to 130, I got extra 10 pounds. And so the resistance keeps increasing. And so that goes for any sport. For instance, let's say a volleyball player or a basketball player goes up with the ball and the arm is all the way up. Well, they're spending a lot of energy by their latissimus dorsi and their lower chest and other muscles pulling that arm down. So if they had more flexibility than what they're actually trying to get, more than 180 degrees, if they had a little bit more, then they wouldn't be fighting the muscles that are pulling the arm down, which means that the skills would be better because, you know, it's less resistance. And at the same time, they would waste a lot less energy. And the same, of course, applies to martial artists. When martial artists perform their techniques, very often they don't get the best results they can because something's pulling them back. When you throw that front kick into the target, now, obviously, you're going to be fighting the resistance from the target, but you're also fighting the resistance from your own body. And, you know, it's from the supporting leg, and it's from the kicking leg, and it's from the torso, and it's from the hip. There's a lot of resistance that somebody's fighting. So the same person can build up more flexibility without building up any extra strength, without training any more than that. You know, if you throw, let's say, 100 front kicks 3 times a week, I wouldn't recommend training like that. But let's say somebody does, for the sake of an argument, they do 100 front kicks on Monday, 100 on Wednesday, 100 on Friday, that's all they do. And that person would do nothing else, just add flexibility to their legs, primarily the posterior chain of the kicking leg and the anterior chain of the supporting leg. They would actually develop a lot more power, a lot more speed just from that, just from not having the antagonist muscles pull the technique back. So the same would apply for a punch, the same would apply for a throw or a takedown or obviously different muscle groups, but the same principle would apply. Now, you said, Bob, is there such thing as being too flexible?
Yes, sir.
Well, the thing is, once again, since the more flexibility you get, the less resistance you encounter, as long as you're stretching the muscles and you're not stretching the joints, you're not stretching the ligaments, and at the same time, you also are stretching them, how should I say this, in such a way that basically you're not putting everything on one muscle. Let's say you bring your arm up for a hammer fist, for instance, or you bring your arm up for inside knife edge strike or something like that. So here you are getting the movement of your shoulder joint, you're getting the movement of your scapula. Most people are going to get the shoulder joint muscles, in this case, let's say the chest, they're going to get stretch in that, but they're not going to get stretch in the muscle that moves the shoulder girdle, the serratus anterior, pectoralis minor. They're not going to get the stretch in that, so they're going to get the shoulder joint doing a lot more work than it should, and the shoulder girdle doing a lot less work than it should. Then that flexibility becomes bad.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's a problem. Then, not that you're too flexible, but you're just not flexible enough in certain areas that the other area has to take over. But if you develop the strength at the same time, and you know that, for instance, you get kicked in a leg, and let's say you get an inside kick to the leg, and you end up in almost in a split or something, granted you could tear your adductors, but if you also strengthen the adductors in that deep range, then you're not too flexible. You just have strength in a deeper range. You don't have what's called unprotected flexibility, and then you're good to go.
Hmm. Wow. Awesome.
Cool.
So I the question.
Yeah, it did. Now, this is something that some martial artists have wondered about. Now, with stretching, that was great information. But I'm pretty sure some other martial artists are wondering, is the strengthening play a part to go along with flexibility also? Because, I mean, I know a lot of people that want to go for the elusive full splits or even the negative splits, but they're not seeing improvement. They hit a wall where they can't go anymore. Now, is that only because they're just stretching and neglecting strengthening exercises, or how does that work? Is strengthening a component to go along with flexibility training?
Well, yes, strengthening is definitely a component. It's not the only component.
Mm-hmm.
I see sometimes people picking that up, and I would say over the last 15, 20 years, strengthening became a lot more of a component of martial arts training as it wasn't before, especially strengthening the muscles they're stretching, because, you know, if somebody wants to stretch, let's say, their hip flexors, but they're doing heavy squats, they're stretching one muscle, they're strengthening another, so that doesn't do much. But recently, people began to focus more on the specific muscles, and it definitely components. Strength training is definitely a component. It will definitely help with flexibility training. It will definitely prevent injuries during flexibility training. But I would say it adds about 20% or so of the whole picture. On top of that, there's massage and release. So important to do that, because there are some muscles that they carry some tension, whether they carry an emotional tension or they carry physical tension from whatever might have happened, and they're just not releasing through flexibility. You have to be really, really good with your breathing and your visualization and your focus on those muscles to be able to release them. And mm-hmm. at the same time, you know, at the same time, you might think that one muscle is tight and it might be radiating from somewhere else. And so even trying to focus on those muscles does not always work. So that's the release part. At the same time, for instance, in our system, we like to isolate. And so, for instance, if you know those that old ball flex that had those ball rods?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
So, you know, if you're trying to set up for a new exercise, and you gotta bend 10 of them at the same time, or you gotta bend one of them at the same time, it's much easier to bend one than mm-hmm. to bend 10. So the same thing with muscles. Muscles are designed in such a way that when you do a scale or when you do a yoga exercise, you will use a lot of muscles in the same movement. I mean, the goal of a scale actually is to use as many muscles as possible. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you know, when you're trying to sew, you know, a kick, you want to include as many muscles and then as many fibers as you can of each muscle. But for flexibility, you don't want to do that because, number one, when you're stretching a muscle, you use some leverage. Either you do it or your partner does it, or there's some leverage somewhere that is being stretched. And the more muscle you're stretching, the stronger leverage there has to be. Sometimes it's just not enough leverage. If you isolate one muscle at a time, then you can focus on them. So that is the first part. Second part, when you stretch all of them together, what happens is some of them will restrict and some of them are actually more flexible. So, for instance, if you're doing a basic hamstring stretch, most people, especially martial artists, because of their techniques, because of how they train, the inner hamstrings are usually a lot, 20, 25, 30 degrees, more flexible than outer hamstrings. So you could check that, you know, if you are sitting down on the floor and you're stretching for a leg in front of you, and then you move that leg out to the side, you will see that you can go a lot closer to your leg when you move it out to the side.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you do that, nobody's getting the benefit. The inner hamstring is not getting stretched because you never get to it, because the outer mm-hmm. hamstring is in the way. And the outer hamstring is really not getting the benefit because, you know, you're trying to push through to stretch the inner hamstring. But if you isolate them, then, you know, you will get both of them. They both will get the benefit. And at some point, the tighter muscle will catch up to the looser muscle, and then you go from there. That's just another point that's used besides the fact that, you know, developing strength for flexibility.
Paul, I think your mic's giving out. Paul, can you hear us?
Yeah, I could hear you.
Okay.
I heard a little bit of static, but now I hear you.
Yeah, okay. That was weird. I think your mic went out for about a second. I don't know what happened there.
I have a question. It's to sort of tad on, I think, more from the beginning, if that's okay for Paul. So would you say, it's Lori, by the way, but would you say then by training your flexibility, does that help with your to make your movements, so to speak, you know, for efficiency, your efficiency of movement, like for kicking or striking, that would be one of the benefits of training your flexibility? Is that right to say?
Well, yes. Training flexibility will decrease the resistance from the antagonistic muscles. So by decreasing that resistance, you automatically function in sort of in an easier environment.
Right.
To say that. So basically, you know, it's like I used this example at some point before. You know, if you have two kids and you know they're both in those what do you call them? You know, those baby things that you put them in and you wheel them around? Mm-hmm. And you push one and you pull in the other one, and one is in front of you and you're pushing it, and the other one is behind you and you're pulling it. It doesn't matter if let's say somebody helps you to push or somebody helps you to pull. As long as you just pulling or just pushing, it's much easier for you. So in a technique, whatever you're applying your force to, that's what you're pushing. And whatever you are pulling behind you, that's the base that you're pulling behind. That's the flexibility. So even if you're not any stronger, you just remove that extra baggage, per se, on you, your technique automatically becomes better. I don't know if I explained it correctly or, I mean, clearly, but, you know, that's how it is, yeah.
Awesome. Cool. All right. And back to you, Bob. I think you have a question,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, Lori, we want your opinion. And Paul, if you have your opinion, please chime in on this. Now that we've discussed how nutrition is important for weight loss or weight gain, how is proper nutrition effective for athletic performance? Does the requirement differ for martial artists specifically?
Should I go first? I can let me go. Okay.
Sure.
Yeah, it's your question. Absolutely.
Okay, great. And please, you know, chime in or ask questions. So, you know, it obviously, you know, it definitely plays a key role for athletic performance. And an elite athlete, or even, you know, just sort of, you know, like if you want to call it a weekend warrior, which is probably more, I don't know about Paul, he sounds a little bit more, but I call myself more of a weekend warrior. And so I work out more than that. It's, you know, I have a job to do and the rest of my life. So it definitely affects performance on many, many levels in terms, whether you want to look at, you know, throughout the day in terms of feeding your body efficiently. You can sort of think of your body, you know, like a car. So if you don't take care of the car, if you don't put, you know, check the oil, if you don't put gas in, you're going to run out of gas. And our bodies are exactly the same way. So that, you know, 24 hours a day. And then if you sort of break that down even further and you look at before you're going to train and even right after you're going to train, depending on what your goal is. And another aspect of that is, you know, we talked earlier about losing weight or gaining weight. So I know I'll use my husband as an example. You know, the way that he's built, he puts on muscle very easily. And for his martial arts training and for his performance, that is not a good thing. He does not want to bulk up because it affects his speed. So he does want to improve his strength, and that's how it's been. You know, he's been practicing over 40 years, but he had to be very careful in his training. Couldn't do a ton of weight training. And with his nutrition, now one affects the other. So if you're trying to put on muscle, you have to eat in such a way, for example, it's meaning you have to eat a lot, and there, you know, this timing is involved in that and some other things to put on muscle. But, you know, for him in particular, that's, you know, not the goal because it affects his training. So I think that's where it becomes sort of more individualized for a martial arts practitioner. Someone who's more of an MMA practitioner, I mean, maybe it's a little bit different because they do want to put size on. I'm not as familiar with that. But, you know, we all want to, you know, eat in a way that, you know, provides us endurance. I know on the days when I'm, you know, going to train with my sensei, you know, and it's an hour private and it's not air conditioning and he's in the valley, which means it's probably about 90, 95 degrees in there, I have to make sure that breakfast is going to sustain me through that intense training and the heat and the amount that I'm perspiring as well. So, I, you know, the hydration becomes important in that as well. So, you know, there's many different levels in terms of performance, depending on what level of an athlete you are. So, very, very effective as a, you know, for the average person and for the elite athlete as well. So if you want to, you know, I don't want to ramble on and get very technical unless you have some questions and you want to ask, but I don't want to just kind of go off and keep the end with some of that stuff.
I, you know what, I do have a question that sort of piles on top of that. You know, as martial artists, we learn discipline. Your husband's part of that, and I'm part of that, and Sifu. What do you, hydration is very crucial, especially when we're out there doing 1,000 kicks and so forth. What do you think, I mean, how do I word it? How crucial is it that it becomes dangerous when a sensei is being very strict and says, no, you're not getting water for another hour, or you're not getting water until you're in your chest, and your chest ends in 6 hours?
Yeah. Well, there's the ideal, and, you know, Paul may have some comment on this because it affects, you know, your muscles and different things. And, you know, certainly, as you said, Bob, you know, my husband and you, you know, you were definitely old school in coming up through training. It's very different now, you know. If we we deprive our students water, we might get sued. So,
yeah.
We don't do those things anymore. But I do think it's crucial. Having said that, you know, our bodies are amazing things, and they are designed to survive. So, you know, obviously there's a point that's what's going to happen if your sensei is one of those that doesn't let you get water. You're going to pass out before you die. Not that that's the effect that you want. In other words, that's your, you know, your body's mechanism of cooling itself down because you're not hydrating, and just sort of saying, okay, time out. So obviously, I'm not saying that that's the right way to go. You know, for us, for me, for, you know, our students, you know, we always say, you know, we drink throughout the class, definitely beforehand. You know, the food, as I mentioned earlier, plays a role in that. But I think generally people go with, you know, eight-ounce glasses of water a day. That's for the average person. And when you're training, you want to add on to that. So, you know, it is something that, you know, I forget the percentage right now, but our bodies are mostly made up of water. So we definitely want to be doing that. And water is best, but other liquids are okay, you know, barring any real, you know, in my opinion, the sugary sodas and stuff like that. I often get a lot of questions about coffee, and coffee is fine, but it also has a dehydrating effect. So you want to probably, you know, add an extra glass of water to counteract that. But again, you know, I think that, again, barring any pre-existing type of condition, you know, your body's going to shut down at some point. But I don't think most people are doing the 3 and 4 hours anymore these days for the average person, like probably you and my husband did, being deprived of water and, you know, kneeling for 4 hours as well.
With the Shania right across the thighs, absolutely.
Oh, man, I remember those days.
I read a couple weeks ago about some sort of formula, and it made sense, but not really. It was, and I forget what it was, and I wanted your input on it. It was like one glass for every 20 pounds of weight. Or something of that, like that. Have you heard of that kind of formula? Instead of the average 8 ounce. Okay.
Yeah, no, I have. I mean, and that, because, you know, obviously my requirement would probably be different than my husband's. I mean, you know, Bob, you can visualize that. You know, the rest of you, you know, he's you know, got, I don't know what it is, probably about 70 pounds on me, thankfully. But it's different for everybody. So, I think that that's accurate. That's why I think, you know, we try to, in the industry, so to speak, make it easy where we say 8 glasses for, you know, eight-ounce glasses. But I think that that's kind of a good formula. We hear that regarding protein requirements and different things as well. So that's a good formula. And if you're not drinking that much, you know, start with, you know, one glass at each meal and one in between, and that gives you 6, you know, or add one, you know, a week for the next week. So cause a lot of people say, you know, it's hard for them to drink that much. But here's a good thing, way to think about it. You know, your body's like a sponge. So when you take a dry sponge and you wet it, it keeps absorbing the water and it keeps absorbing the water and then eventually gets saturated. Well, that's really the point you want your body to be at any time of the day, in any weather, is saturated so that it's working optimally. Your, you know, muscles and everything are being hydrated effectively, so nutrients can be carried through your body. So I always like to use that sort of sponge analogy, because when you're thirsty, that means that the sponge is dry. That's the that's sort of your body's defense mechanism, and you really don't want to get to that point in reality. You know, a thirst is a sign that there's some sort of deficiency going on.
Oh, great answer.
Cool.
Oh, my God.
I love it. I know. This question goes to Paul. Paul, speaking of hydration or dehydration, how would both affect the flexibility training? I mean, obviously that, you know, if we're dehydrated, your muscles are going to be like, hey, what are we doing? And probably shut down. But how would that, so let's just say, I'll give you an example. I remember when I took my, one of my black belt tests, it was 8 hours, no water, in a purposefully heated room. Right. And I kind of see the point. I wanted to see who was going to give up and stuff like that. No one gave up, but, you know, somebody's muscles did give up and cramped and violently contracted. I was wondering, you know, if either you, Paul, or Lori can explain, you know, why our muscles tend to do that and why it's and why that's probably not a great thing.
I would say I'm not. This is my opinion. This is my research. I may not be right, but I'm not quite sure if it's necessarily the dehydration that causes that, or if the minerals come out with the water that causes that. Because I mean, for instance, I know that soldiers in certain countries. They get different salts, and they perform a lot better. They don't get more water necessarily. They get salts, which help them to retain, number one, water. Two, it prevents electrolyte loss. I personally try my best not to drink water that doesn't have electrolytes in them. I think that loss of the basic core magnesium, potassium, sodium, and calcium will cause problems when somebody's training, especially if somebody's training an empty stomach, and or if somebody's training an empty stomach and they drank something like distilled water, and that water by itself is going to get some of those minerals and then take them out. So I think that's more of a cause, but maybe Lori has a different answer.
You know, just from a sort of physiological, technical aspect, when you're doing work, there's something called lactic acid that builds up in your muscles. I think what Paul said for him not drinking a lot of water, some people definitely feel that way. I think my husband's one of those. I'm the opposite. So for me, you know, there's sort of what science shows us, the way the human body works. But then as individuals, we each experience something different. My husband doesn't like to eat a lot before he works out. I couldn't get through 5 minutes if I didn't have a good meal. So that's where the individuality plays a role. But as far as, you know, cramping up in your workout, water begins to play a role, because when you're at that sort of, you know, you're what you were explaining, Rosita, about an eight-hour thing, which is obviously not typical and extreme, because as your muscles do work, there's something called lactic acid that builds up in the muscle, and that's when you start to have cramping, and that has to do with your breathing heavy also, so you're not getting as much oxygen. So the water can play a role in helping to remove the lactic acid, but at that point, I don't think the water is honestly going to make a difference. It's over time it would, but it wouldn't have an immediate effect. So it really has to do with a very sort of, on a cellular level, what starts to happen when you are working out at that intensity. It's sort of like, you know, if you've ever done any weight training and you're lifting weights and you're doing a set, and you reach muscle fatigue, that's from the lactic acid buildup. So, you know, you got to rest for that to sort of energy process within the muscle system to be balanced out again, I guess is the right way to say it. But I agree with Paul, because electrolytes play a great role in that as well. There's differing opinions on drinking that all the time and only that, and I personally actually don't know a huge amount about that, but that's sort of the whole, that plays a role in the whole thing as well, because when you sweat, you lose salt or sodium, and the sodium plays a role also in the cramping. Just that's how the balance of water within muscle tissues actually work. It's a sort of a balance between sodium and potassium, which is usually at least some of what's contained in these drinks that have electrolytes in them. So sorry again if I get too technical, but that's that's kind of what's happening there. So water can help, and I think, you know, Paul is right that some of these other drinks can help, and you kind of have to, you know, kind of go step by step as one person and see, meaning an individual, and see, you know, what works for you, what, you know, when you can, unless, of course, you're in that black belt 8-hour test and, you know, that's testing your, obviously, your perseverance. So
yeah.
You're going to fight through.
Yeah, that was, you know, I tell my students about it and I tell them, you know, don't worry, I'm not going to make you do that. Because I definitely did not feel healthy the morning after.
Yeah, yeah.
I couldn't walk, and that reminded me of there was a lady that was testing with me, and she like cramped up. I mean, to the point where like her arms and her legs were like in this like contracted position. It looked almost unnatural, right? And the teachers fed her just straight up salt water, so table salt, you know, in a big water jug, and they told her to drink it all. And well, she did, but then she ended up puking it all out just a few minutes later. And I thought, wow, this doesn't look like it's helping either. You know, two extremes, right? You know, complete dehydration and muscle contraction, and then force feeding a lot of salt water all at once. And you know, your body's got to go through some type of shock, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. But isn't it interesting that whoever it was, they knew enough that she needed the salt. Like, I thought, you know, it was overkill, you're right, it was one extreme or the other, but, you know, hopefully, even though she had to go through that, again, the unpleasantness of, you know, puking it up, as you said.
Yeah.
At least hopefully it helps the muscle contractions. So,
yeah.
You know, a more watered down version, you know, of that or something. But, you know, I mean, these are the things that we see, you know, all the time, I think, with elite athletes being pushed to that brink. And it, of course, happened more so, you know, in our years coming up through, especially the, you know, old school martial arts stuff. You know, we're here to tell about it, and you got some good stories. So.
Yes, we are. Now, I guess this question is going to be geared toward both of you again. Now, Lori, earlier you mentioned a little bit about the individual like requirements. What works for one person might not work for another. And Paul mentioned the same thing too. But on a nutritional aspect, do nutritional requirements differ between men and women as far as the sexes are concerned?
Oh, definitely. You know, depending on your goal, again, because it's always the bottom line, you know, there's definitely a calorie difference in terms of the amount of food to eat, you know, day to day, even just maintaining calories, because men and women were designed differently. You know, men naturally have more muscle, which is why they can eat more food, because it takes more calories to maintain muscle. That's, you know, we women, you know, are blessed to get to have children, so God made us that way, which, you know, there's a reason why we carry more fat, because he, you know, made us to carry the children, and that helps us to do that. Of course, we have to live with those things every day. So that right off the get-go makes us definitely different in terms of those requirements. And for the same reasons, we have different, you know, when you get down to the baseline of nutrients in terms of vitamins and minerals specifically, aside from calories, we definitely have different requirements for those same reasons. And then I think within those categories, depending on your lifestyle, that then plays another role, because if you have somebody who's a martial artist, you know, like whether it's a competitive athlete who's a martial artist, needs a different set of things versus the, you know, our, you know, adult students. We have a 67-year-old man who's in our classes, and he has different requirements certainly than I do, or the 13-year-old at our dojo. So it really varies. And in my experience, I really feel strongly, I have seen that it, you know, varies very much from individual to individual. And again, I'm going to use my husband and I as an example. He is a vegetarian, and he, you know, would rather die, I think, before he ate some meat. he does eat eggs and cheese, but he just does not feel good eating that way. I, on the other hand, you know, would be like sleeping through the day if I didn't have some protein. I don't eat a lot of meat, but so we're kind of just, we're made differently. And it's not just because, you know, he's male and I'm female, because I see it with even in my women friends that I, you know, spent a lot of years just, I'll use myself as the example of determining, well, you know, I feel much better if I, you know, a certain way, whereas somebody else, you know, can eat the opposite and they thrive in that way. So that's just sort of where my focus has been over the years of being in the nutrition field, is really helping people to define that. And the reason for that is because let's take you and I, Rosita, because this is the easiest example. If we both want to lose 10 pounds, I mentioned the mass part of that earlier, you know, 3,500 calories equal 1 pound. So if we each eat 3,500 calories less a week, we should, in theory, each lose a pound a week if that's our goal. But the makeup of those calories, whatever that amount is, can play a role in making me feel better. So in other words, for me, I like a larger percentage of protein over carbohydrates with some fat added. So what that translates to is, even though you and I would eat the same amount of calories, if I can feel better, that means probably I will move more and not feel tired or lethargic or have brain fog. So that will help me sort of in my endeavor to lose that weight, which is really the goal in terms of being comfortable and also not stressing the body. Because, you know, let's admit, you know, let's just say it. It's, you know, not easy to lose weight sometimes. It takes a lot of discipline. So you want to make somebody feel as good as they can. So that's where those things play a role as well. And then if you add the elite athlete aspect onto that in terms of performance, that's a whole other level. In terms of, you know, what each sort of food group does for us, the carbohydrate versus the protein versus fats, et cetera. So I'm sure Paul can definitely add to that, but there you go.
let's get back to Paul then. So does stretching workouts or techniques differ between men and women because of the differences in body structure?
Well, I was actually going to... add what Lori was saying before. I think I think you mentioned Ayurveda at some point.
I didn't hear that. I'm sorry.
I think you mentioned the Ayurveda at some point, the Indian method of medicine.
Well, I think you guys did maybe earlier, Rosita, maybe.
I didn't catch the last part. My headset's like tripping. I didn't catch the last part of what
I think it was
Paul
Ayurveda,
said.
Like the in. I think it was Indian.
Yeah. I did a health news bit about the holy basil and how its benefits through the Ayurvedic sense.
Speaking of that, the martial arts and their needs. I think there's one difference that I found. I'm going to talk about that in a second. That martial artists have, like, one difference from other athletes. But in general, I mean, the way I go by in terms of nutrition, my recommendations, besides the number of calories and stuff like that, I also go by a time, for instance, time of the year, you know, cooling foods, summer, warming and foods in winter, trying to go anti-cold, anti-dryness or something like that in the winter. So, you know, that would change depending on, you know, the situation, time of the year, of course, individual needs and size of the body. And also, for martial artists, there's something that I sort of see in martial arts that, and this is hard style martial arts usually, not soft style, that I see that other athletes usually, not always, usually don't have. I mean, you have more violent sports like rugby and football, and you would see that more. But hard style martial arts, when they practice against their teams, very often, when they do patterns or forms or patterns or whatever you want to call it, they visualize, at least they should visualize their targets. Now, the problem is, I don't know if you remember Bruce Lee, when he was trying to shoot him to enter the dragon, he said emotion, not anger. Do you remember that
mm-hmm.
play?
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of martial artists don't know how to do that, and they use anger. So that they see an opponent, and they think, okay, my hands are chamber now, I'm going to just throw, and they yell, and they throw that punch, and whatever, but they use anger.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's okay for children and teenagers, but as people become older and they constantly visualize somebody attacking them, they constantly use anger, they constantly yell, that drives the nervous system crazy. As you know from Chinese medicine, liver is severely damaged by anger. You have
mm-hmm.
the difference in the kidneys, all that outburst of adrenaline. So the martial artists who practice it that way, they need some compensations. There's a compensations on a physical level, which would be certain breathing exercises or fishing exercises. And there's, compensations on other levels. But in a nutrition level, I think certain foods, it calms the body down, help. And I've seen this effect a few times. And basically, foods like berries and avocado and salmon, they have a calming effect on the body. And martial artists can use that, not necessarily for their performance, but let's say for their sanity, to be more calm after an hour and a half, or 45 minutes of pretending like they're beating somebody up and sending out that negative energy. And because, whatever you send out bounces right back to you, and, and then they all wire up and stuff like that. And certain forms of nutrition, especially certain foods, calm the body down. And a specific example, for instance, a friend of mine, he trained at night and he performed his forms. I think it was Friday evening, and for Sunday he had a tournament. And he sent me a text and he goes, I really can't sleep. And so I said, well, sit down and breathe and meditate and whatever. He said, I don't do that new age stuff. Do you have anything stronger? So I said, well, the only fact you recommend is late. You don't want to eat late. Eat blueberries. He had a lot of blueberries, and he actually fell asleep, and he was pretty calm.
Mm-hmm.
So,
wow.
Food, balancing out, the heart style of martial arts and all those things. Anyway, so, yeah. You said something about question was a question, but unfortunately I forgot it now.
Go ahead.
You said something about stretching after, before I started talking, but I forgot the question.
Oh, the question was, do stretching techniques, do they tend to differ, stretching techniques, do they tend to differ between men and women, considering that our bodies are structured a little bit differently?
Not really. The osteo stretching. Hello?
Mm-hmm.
Not really. There are a few exceptions. Obviously, the women have certain angle of the hip.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit of a difference. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that actually I've been researching not too long ago is the adductors. The adductors is a very funny thing because we know that some of them flex, some of them extend. And, of course, the adductors, that's what the adductors. But some of them rotate the hip out, and some of them rotate the hip in. And if you look at the 20 studies, you're going to roughly get 9 saying they rotate in, and then 11 saying they rotate out. And, for physiological stretches, for what I do, that's very important. Do you position the hip to rotate it in, to rotate it out, when trying to get those muscles? And I found that men and women sometimes will have different rotation of the same muscle that stretches them. Just because of the different position of the pelvis and a wider pelvis and a larger pew angle for women as opposed to men.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably the only difference. Women, on average, are usually more flexible than men. You know, that's a standard. Not all women, of course, and not all men, but on average, women are more flexible than men.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Awesome. Thanks. Barbara, you still online there? Or are you on mute?
I am.
Oh, okay.
Every once in a while, just check and just nudge me a little bit.
I'm like,
Paul,
I'm sorry, Bob.
Paul, for the martial artist, what would be an appropriate way to stretch during a regular class?
Great question.
Different way to stretch during the class. Well, a couple of things. Number one, you have to know what you're stretching for. Sometimes you stretch for flexibility. Sometimes you stretch for recovery. And it's not the same thing. For instance, when you stretch for recovery, you do not look to increase the range of motion. You just look to drive the nutrients and to circulate blood to the tissues and open up more contracted tissues, as opposed to when you're looking for flexibility, it's done differently. That's number one. Number two, stretching for a specific class, if you're talking about martial arts, depends on which martial arts you do. You know, an Aikido practitioner will be stretching his wrist, for instance, and his shoulder joint a lot more than a Taekwondo practitioner. You know, and Taekwondo practitioner will be focused on low body a lot more. You know, so as somebody who does judo and wrestling would spend a great deal on the neck and torso and rotation and all that. So it depends on, you know, first of all, it depends on the skill, it depends on specific system. In terms of the skill, it depends which skills you're going to work on that day. So stretching has to sort of support the lead up to the skill. You know, so it's really not, I mean, it's not like a question that has a standard answer. It changes depending on, I mean, if you're working on the kicks, but you're working on the speed that day, or you're working on strength, power of the kick, or you're working on the height of the kick, or you're working on the focus of the kick, you're going to get different stretching exercises, and you're going to get different types of warm-ups. It's the same technique, but, you know, the muscles are going to do different things. You know, for instance, when you're working on precision, you know, it doesn't matter that much how fast you go if you work on precision before speed. So, you know, you're not going to do that many dynamic stretches because that will actually take away from precision. You know, stuff like that. So it's really, you know, it depends on so many factors. The level of your students, your style, the technique you're going to work on, you know, how much warm-up you had, is it warm outside, is it cold outside? You know, the whole, you know, stretching and warm-up, it's not like a standard answer thing that I can just, you know, sort of throw out there. You know?
Well, that's understandable because, you know, everyone's so different. It just reminds me of, like, you know, and I know this happened to Sifu Bob, too, and me, and a lot of old school martial artists. So this question would be directed more toward you, Paul. I remember when I was a kid, we would do, you know, the old school butterfly stretch, but we would have someone standing on our knees and kind of like bouncing us down and stuff like that, right? And it hurt like hell. I saw a little bit of like flexibility improvement and stuff like that, but then I was like back to where I was, after the hurt went away and stuff. What are your thoughts on that type of stretching? I mean, would that be considered a type of ballistic stretching or not recommended at all? Or what would your thoughts be on that, Paul?
Okay, well, that's butterfly stretch. I'm not going to go too technical, but I would like to sort of give a background to what I'm about to say so it doesn't come out of nowhere.
Okay.
The butterfly search focuses on the upper adductors, which is basically all the adductors except for the lower part of the adductor magnus. And it also focuses on some hip flexors. So what you get with the butterfly stretch, because of that lateral rotation of the hips and adduction of the hips, you're working, you're trying to stretch the same muscles that are keeping you up. In other words, you know, when you're sitting up, you know, your body is vertical. There are some muscles that are holding you from falling back, right? Back on your back. Well, those muscles are the same muscles that you are now stretching in the butterfly, which is not a good way to do it. So, I mean, you have certain muscles that are trying to hold you up. At the same time, they're contracting because, you know, you just told them, that's your job, hold me up, I don't want to fall back. You're not going to fall forward. Those people are not that flexible, so you're going to fall back. And at the same time, you begin to force the muscles to relax, and it doesn't, you know, it's like you have a I don't know, an army, and one general is saying go forward, and one is saying retreat, and the army is like, what do you want me to do? So that's what's being done to those muscles. So if somebody's staying on your leg, this is what happens. Why it works. When somebody, I'm not saying it's a good thing, but it works for a while, and this is what happens. When somebody's standing your leg, they usually support themselves by placing their hands on your back, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, by placing their hands on your back, they push you forward. So by pushing you forward, the function of the muscles of keeping you up from falling back, now that's taken out because somebody's pushing you forward. And because that's taken out, the muscle can now concentrate on, you know, releasing, and then somebody stands on your legs and, you know, they come out to the side. But after that happens, the person gets off, and you're back to square one.
Nice.
Now you gotta use those muscles for two functions again. One is saying release, and the other saying contract. So the only way that would work is if a couple of things. Something I do not recommend, but if somebody severely overstretched those muscles over time, then it would work. And for somebody to do that, you have to sit on something like a foam roller, and your knees have to go past the horizontal line. So that's not something you want to do. The more optimal way of doing it, of course, is to get your body to fall forward naturally. Most people are not that flexible, so you would have to sit on something, and by elevating your hips while still keeping your feet on the floor, you will get that angle. You'll get the same 90-degree angle, but now it's tilted forward, and now you don't have to worry about holding yourself up. And if you do that, then you have to protect your ankles, because now you have your toes on the floor, your heels off the floor, and you're flexing down, and you're seriously hurting the ligament outside of the ankle. So butterfly stretch is not an easy stretch to deal with. It's not an easy, you know, it's not, how should I say this, the standard way of doing it is not a good way of doing it. I mean, what I personally do is I take those muscles apart, the adductor, the upper part of adductor magnus, longus, brevis, and the tectinius there. I take them quite as much as possible. I do them one by one using kinesiological stretches. And even then, it takes a little bit longer for that than for something like hamstring stretch or, you know, doing splits and stuff like that. It's a very tricky position, the butterfly. And in terms of, is it healthy somebody staying on your leg? That might be a little bit too much leverage for most people to handle. And usually what happens is the muscles are contracted to hold you up, and then somebody releases that, and the muscles think, well, I've just been under so much stress, and they're too tired to too tired to fight the pressure of the person saying they let go. And so your knees come down to the floor, but like I said, they're going to go back up. And, you know, hopefully without injury, because if somebody is very inflexible, there might be an injury. If somebody's knees are like an inch from the floor, okay. But if somebody's knees are, I don't know, 6 or 8 or 12 inches off the floor and somebody stands on the leg, you know, you fight that person's weight with your adducts as much as you can, but once you can't, they might hurt them, you know.
Oh, ouch.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, don't think.
Yeah.
Lori, this next question is for you. Can you give our listeners some tips on how to increase or maintain energy levels throughout the day?
Absolutely. You know, the way that we, most people, I think, live our lives today, you know, we're stuck sitting at a desk until we get to class at night. Unfortunately,
right.
Not everybody. So, you know, Paul can probably speak more to this, but from the physical aspect is, you know, like I even will tell people, set a timer on your watch every hour and get up and take a walk around your building if you can, or certainly, you know, once in the morning, or get up and stretch. So that's just, you know, part of it will help. But from the nutritional aspect, you know, really eating regularly and consistently smaller meals throughout the day is really the best thing, because it's all about keeping your blood sugar level stable. So I usually recommend that people eat, you know, every 2 to 4 hours. That might sound extreme, but certainly, you know, 4 or 5 hours at the most, because what happens is, you know, your blood sugar levels drop, and then that's usually when people, you know, crave something and they get a headache, and then you make a poor choice. So there's that aspect to it as well. So it sounds, you know, it's kind of a simple answer in a way, but the best thing is to plan out the day or plan out your week. You know, there's this expression a lot of people have heard, I'm sure, it's, you know, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail. So really, you know, I remember, you know, when I was working in an office still, I had a drawer, and in one of those drawers, you know, was snacks, you know, whatever those snacks were, you know, because sometimes I'd get stuck and I'd be on conference calls or in meetings all day and, you know, whatever might happen. And so you really just want to make a conscious effort to be eating every 2 to 4 hours, small, you know, smaller meals then, so to stay within whatever, you know, your calorie, you know, allotment or what you desire. Is, but that's really the best thing in terms of keeping energy stable. And then sort of certainly within that is what you choose for those meals to be. You know, like I mentioned earlier, for me, you know, I know certain foods, I just don't feel great when I eat them. So obviously those are not my snacks. I try to avoid those things. And that takes a little bit more work and time in figuring those things out, you know, for you in particular as an individual, it's sort of a deeper level. But in general, certainly it's, you know, every 2 to 4 hours.
Awesome.
very
awesome.
Cool.
No, we've only got about 10 minutes left to the show. I just looked at the clock and went, what happened? Where did all our time go?
Right.
It sure goes by quick. So before we end the show, Paul, can you tell us a little bit about your flexibility training certification? I think it's called Elastic Steel Professional Fast Flexibility Training Certification. I hope I got that right. Can you tell us a little bit about it, and how can the listeners contact you about that?
What it is basically, just as it's called, it's a fast way to get flexibility. That's what it is. It's a fast way to become flexible. There's a number of standards that are in there. We have something specific for keeping flexibility. In other words, there are exercises, kinesiological stretches, which is a new form of stretching. Get the flexibility rather quickly. But a lot of people would say, well, I'm going to get flexible, I'm going to lose it. Not to lose it, we have something called extended range conditioning, which basically blends your body's natural range of motion, which it had before, with a new range of motion. So your body begins to accept the new range of motion as its natural range of motion, and this way the nervous system doesn't say, well, I don't want to go there again. I was forced there before, but I don't want to go, I'm not comfortable. Another system that the flexibility steps That's number one. Number two, we have something called the physical condition that basically allows the person to use the flexibility. In other words, you know, you can take a leg, go plunk it to somebody's waist, and then you plunk it and take that leg and bring it to the head level. But the second you let go, it's going to fall back to the waist level. So what is the point if you have the flexibility? You can't use it. We have exercises that allow the person not only to become flexible, but to use that flexibility. You know, so that is basically the system. It's two parts. One focuses on the upper body, neck, shoulder girders, shoulder joint, wrists and hands. And one focuses on the lower body, the core, the hips, pelvis, knees, and ankles. And, you know, it's like a amino acid. Basically, it can be used for anything. It's yoga. It's very specific. This could be used for anything. Basically, once you got a flexibility in a specific muscle, you can combine it into anything you want and into any sport and any activity. And then, if somebody wants to contact, either forelasticsteel.com or elasticsteel.com.
Got it. Elasticsteel.com. All right. I'll be putting that link up on the Dynamic Dojo Radio show page for our listeners so that way they can contact you if they have any questions about any type of stretching. So very cool.
Very
awesome.
Laura, can you tell us a little bit about the three-step nutrition coaching process that you provide? And how many of our listeners contact you about information or consultation?
Absolutely. I'd be happy to. So basically my husband and I came up with this three-step process. It's, you know, not earth-shattering, anything people haven't heard, but we basically, the first step is, we call it an analysis and action plan. And it's really just an information gathering. So we can help determine what your goals are and then formulate a corrective plan to help you. And also, you know, just find out about what your lifestyle is like. So that will help. You know, what's your commitment level, you know, what's realistic, et cetera. So that's, you know, what we'll do sort of in that first phase, if you will, in the analysis. And then the middle, which is really the most important phase, which we sort of just named it guidance, we will determine a plan and educate you on food intake choices based on what your goal is. And we've come up with these different packages that will include a supplement recommendation. We've partnered with a company, it's my old boss actually, it's called DotFit, which has an online resource for logging food. And they also have a fabulous line of supplements that are produced in a pharmaceutical facility. So there's some regulation there, which you don't usually find with products. I know we didn't get to talk about that much, but our packages, so we'll do supplements, it'll be food, some core exercises, and all of this, obviously, the movement part of it will be martial arts. So depending on your goal, there'll be certain katas maybe that are recommended for you, whether it's weight loss or increased energy or building muscle or improving flexibility. So that's really individualized to the person. And one of the wonderful things about partnering with DotFit is it's, as I mentioned earlier, it's online. So I can do everything remotely. You don't have to see me personally. We can do stuff over the phone. I have the ability to log into this site and see everything that's going on with you. We even have a body monitor that can figure out exactly how many calories you're expending. So that's pretty cool. It kind of takes the guesswork out of what you're doing. So if you know what you're expending, then you know what you need to be eating. And then once you reach your goal, the last part is maintenance. We'll just continue to work alongside you, giving support as needed and sort of tweaking things as you go. And, you know, as we started out earlier just talking about fad diets and everything, you know, we see typically people will do that. And as you mentioned, you know, falling off the bandwagon. You know, our goal is really to help people find a better lifestyle. That's really what I think we're all looking for. You know, we all might have a passion for martial arts. We want to be able to do that our whole lives. We want to be healthy doing that. So whether we help you find that martial arts is your passion, you know, or it is already, or whatever you do, the nutrition component, you know, plays really 80 to 90% of you, you know, being healthy and feeling good in doing whatever those activities are. And obviously, that, as I mentioned, that's our goal, is just to help people, you know, have a better lifestyle and feel better in all the things that they do. And as far as contacting us, you can call us directly. It's an easy number. It's 888, and it's MIM Dojo, so that's easy, or 646-3656. And you can also email us directly and get a hold of me. I'm usually the one who fields those emails right now through our website, which is mastersinmotion.com. You can also get there through kibukan.com. So if that's what you remember, since we're Kibukan Nutrition. So any of those ways, and you can definitely find us, and we'll be happy to help.
Awesome.
Very cool. Yeah.
Wow. I wish we had more time for the show. It might just turn out that we might have to do like a part two.
Maybe.
You know, sometime in the future. And, you know, what I'm interested in doing is actually setting up like maybe something like a more of a call-in type of thing. So, you know, that way if, martial artists or athletes, you know, did have specific questions based on their own sport or martial art for either one of you, that it could be, you know, addressed in that sort of fashion. But that's something that we can talk about like sometime in the future. But definitely there's a lot more information out there that I know you two would be very helpful in letting the martial art community and the athlete community know about. And Bob and I haven't even gotten through all of the questions that we wanted to get through today.
right.
We were actually worried about that. We were like, oh, I don't know if we're going to be able to get, I don't know if we're going to have more questions, you know, after this. And we didn't even get through them all because we had a bunch. But thank you so much, Paul and Lori, for joining us. It was such a pleasure to have you on. And thank you so much for
taking the time
out of your busy schedule to join us today.
You're welcome, and thank you so much for asking, and anytime. It's been great. A lot of fun.
Awesome.
Thank you, Lori.
And thank you, Paul, for taking the time out of your busy schedule. Thank you again.
Thank you again.
Awesome. All righty.
Let's talk about next week's show. It's going to be Martial Art of the Gun with our guests, Alan Ogusa and Kent Turnip Seed, the founder of the Turnip Seed Technique that teaches shooting and safety and firearms out of Arizona now. You teach out of California. This month we're also going to have our protocol show and special guest Malia Bernal, if we can make the arrangement.
It's going to be an exciting next few weeks of shows, so listeners, please stay tuned. Thank you, listeners, for being really loyal listeners and supporting the show. And I also want to thank again Lori and Paul for joining us. And, of course, thank you, Bob, for being the best co-host that I could ever ask for. Awesome. So we will talk to everybody next time. Have a great rest of the day, everyone. We'll talk to you all next time. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.